CXL checks out. Cisco's ISO interest. Partners on pause. Mitchell makes an exit. Riding the Emerald Rapids. A Figma int of Adobe's imagination. And a closer look at Intel's AI plans in this first episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown of 2024. Hi, everyone. I'm Tom Hollingsworth, and welcome to the January 3rd episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. I am joined by my effervescent co-host, Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, happy 2024.
I can't believe it's already here. Or as we know it in offices, happy getting the date wrong on everything you type into a spreadsheet and then having them sort wrong day.
Well, you know what you need to do, Stephen, is you need to take a nice long drink because it is National Drinking Straw Day. But you can also take a little bit of time to hear about all of the great news stories that we have coming up on this episode of The Rundown, because while everybody else seemed to be on holiday for the last couple of weeks, the news wasn't. So we're going to catch you up on some things that have been going on that you're going to want to keep in mind. And we're going to start off with an interesting story about CXL, because if you were kind of wondering to see what might happen in the real world before you were ready to dive in with both feet, the wait is over. Samsung revealed that they've successfully verified CXL memory in a user environment working with Red Hat. The memory has been optimized to run on Red Hat Enterprise Linux 9.3, was verified in KVM and Podman environments in the customer. The goal is for customers to be able to adopt CXL from Samsung without the need to adjust any additional hardware in their deployments. Support for CXL memory will come from the Samsung Memory Research Center, which covers a wide range of devices, not just RAM. So, Stephen, you're a huge proponent of CXL, and you've been trying to get people really excited about it. How important is it that if the memory has been validated in real production?
Yeah, this is a good story, a huge story. As you know, if you've listened to our Utilizing Tech podcast, I'm really keen on basically the not just cool tech, but when tech gets real, when it's useful, when it's practical, when you can just deploy it and use it and get the benefits of it, and you don't have to mess around with it. Because if there's one thing I learned as a systems administrator in enterprise production environments, you don't want to mess around with stuff. You only use things that are supported by everyone involved, things that just friggin' work. And that's what Samsung's doing here. So they, pat on the back to Samsung. They worked really hard to come up with a CXL memory expansion module, as have many other companies, by the way. But Samsung took the next step and worked with Red Hat to certify it. They showed that it works. They showed that it plugs in. Everything is compatible. Everything's interoperable. And I might add a story that we're going to cover later in the rundown. Intel's latest Xeon server processors also support CXL memory expansion out of the box. That's an official supported feature. It wasn't in the fourth generation, but it is in the fifth generation. So what this means is that whether you're using AMD or Intel, you can buy a Samsung memory expansion module, and you can expect that it's going to work, at least in a Red Hat environment, if you're using KVM, Podman, etc., which are kind of the popular things that are being used out there in cloud deployments. And of course, that's, again, what this stuff is all about. So let me give you a brief refresher on why this is important. CXL is cool, sure, because you're moving stuff away from the CPU. You know, you're connecting them over PCI Express, potentially even outside the box. But what's actually more practical cool is the fact that you can use memory expanders to affordably match memory workloads to needs. So as you know, most servers have a certain number of memory channels, and best practices call for populating all of those channels so you can get the maximum memory bandwidth. The problem is memory only comes in certain sizes, binary sizes. And so the idea is this trend called non-binary memory, which sounds a little on point newsworthy outside the tech industry, but in the tech industry, what it means is basically using a CXL module to expand memory in a more granular fashion so that you can have exactly the right amount of memory for this server. Instead of overbuying, which is what we've always had to do, because underbuying memory is a great way to make your server garbage. Overbuying is basically what we've always had to do, but the problem is overbuying often means literally doubling server costs because memory is so expensive, especially when you step up to the next size. So what this means is that we can match memory sizes, which optimizes costs, And now that it's supported, we can expect that that's actually going to work. So kudos, Samsung, kudos, Red Hat, and big kudos to the CXL consortium for pushing this forward. Cisco decided to spend some of their Christmas gift money early by announcing their intent to acquire cloud-native networking and security company Isovalent, who's very familiar to us here at Gestalt IT. The company is famous for the development of eBPF, a critical component for systems visibility. eBPF powers Cilium, which is an open-source project that utilizes the tool to provide security and connectivity for things like Google GKE, Amazon EKS Anywhere, and more. Isovalent has had over $70 million in investment leading up to the acquisition. They were doing a pretty good job, too, in what they were building. So this is kind of exciting, right, Tom?
I think it is. And not just for the reasons that, you know, oh, they're going to get a lot of access to resources. Cisco was actually an investor in one of those funding rounds that they took. So, you know, Cisco's had their eye on Isovalent for a while. It's the fact that Isovalent is going to their security solutions group, not just the cloud group. So this is going to be an integral component of a lot of other things that are going on in Cisco. And I talked to some of the delegates over the break about this. There was a great back and forth going on between some of our security friends, some of our cloud friends. And one of the exciting things that's going to happen is the fact that eBPF is going to be an integral part of a lot of different things going forward. That visibility that you get from using the enhanced Berkeley packet filter is a massive win for people who are trying to keep an eye on things. I mean, if it can sort out container networking and visibility, you know it has a lot of power. That's one of the things that a lot of people have been struggling for years with. However, one of the, I don't know if you want to call it hitches in the deal, or maybe some of the concern in the industry, is what happens to tools like Cilium, which are open source and kind of foundational to what a lot of other people are trying to build. And that's always a big concern, right? We've seen that over the course of the last year. What happens when an open source project changes their licensing or they go private or something like that? I think what's going to happen is that Cilium may end up eventually getting donated to the Linux Foundation. It's another thing that we've seen a lot of in 2023. There are companies that say, I want this project to succeed and I want it to have the resources that it needs. So I'm going to send it to a place where it can be cared for. And the Linux Foundation has been the recipient of a lot of those things. And I think that that will allow Cilium to continue to nurture, to continue to grow, and continue to be a part of a large user base, while at the same time allowing the enhancements to the software and to eBPF to flow back up into the commercial product. Because let's be fair, deploying Cilium at enterprise scale is hard. And what you need is help. And with the complexity that goes into a modern network when it comes to security and visibility, you don't want to wing it. This is not the old days when we were deploying cacti to 1,000 systems and just YOLOing our way through life. These are mission-critical systems that require mission-critical support contracts. And if there's a company out there that's capable of doing that, it's our friends over at Cisco. I would expect to see a lot more about this in the coming weeks. Maybe we'll see if we can get somebody to talk about it when we go to Cisco Live later in February. VMware customers aren't the only folks that are getting some interesting emails. Before the break, Broadcom announced to all existing VMware partners that their agreements would be vacated on February the 4th. They will need to reapply to the program in order to continue to be VMware partners going forward. At that time, Broadcom will let them know if they are eligible to continue under revised rules for the program. So what are those rules? Well, nobody knows right now, but some of the industry insiders have been letting it slip that companies may need to have over $500,000 in VMware revenue in order to be considered for the program, which could leave some of the smaller MSPs and service provider organizations out in the cold. Now, Stephen, we talked about this a little bit in our year-end episode. This was a huge blockbuster acquisition, but there's still some uncertainty about where things are going to go next. What do you think is going on with VMware kind of having their partner program put on pause?
Well, this is sort of to be expected from Broadcom. Frankly, Broadcom is the kind of company that aggressively makes the alleged benefits of acquisitions and mergers happen. And frankly, from a business perspective, you look at this and you got to give Broadcom management a lot of credit. they had to cool their jets and wait and wait and wait to get this acquisition approved. But as soon as it was approved, they are executing on a lot of the promises that every company makes whenever there's an acquisition. I mean, think about it. What do we hear whenever there's a big corporate acquisition? There's going to be synergies, there's going to be cost savings, there's going to be, you know, new packaging, new pricing, new licensing models. That's what happens when companies get acquired, honestly, including this one. And what happens next? Well, sometimes doesn't live up to that promise. Think about a lot of the failed corporate acquisitions and mergers that you've seen out there. Why did they so-called fail? In a lot of cases, it was because there was resistance from the acquired company or their partners or their customers who basically said, no, we don't want these synergies and efficiencies to happen. Broadcom's not going to let that happen. Broadcom is stepping right in here, right at the very start, and obviously they've been working on this for quite a while, and saying, no, we are resetting things. I'll tell you, as a Broadcom supplier, they quickly contacted us and said, we're switching over to Broadcom's supplier systems and the Broadcom name. Same is happening with Broadcom's partners and customers. They're going to move aggressively to move these things into Broadcom to realize a lot of those synergies that are happening. And as we expected, they're going to rationalize how they work with the market. Now, $500,000 sounds like a lot of money to normal people. It's a lot of money to me. But let me tell you, that's not a lot of money in the enterprise tech world. And so I'm not at all surprised that Broadcom is reevaluating small partners, because VMware probably had a huge number of small partners. I mean, the company's been in business for a long time. It has a lot of different partners and different resellers around the world. And many of these partners and resellers probably weren't worth the effort from a VMware Broadcom perspective to service, because they probably had a lot of the same needs as the bigger partners. So I'm not really surprised that Broadcom is pressing the big old reset button on partner agreements. Now, this might in fact impact customers in some ways, because your favorite little partner might no longer be able to access VMware licenses directly. But that being said, I'm sure that there are going to be middlemen and other suppliers and other ways to continue this. But it does mean that Broadcom is going to slim down the number of customers they work with. They're going to try to make sure that those customers are basically worth the effort in working with them. And I'm not at all surprised that the company is doing this. So again, this is the next step in Broadcom's VMware evolution, and it is a predictable one and frankly not all that concerning to me. Mitchell Hashimoto, a famous name in tech, announced in mid-December that he would be departing his namesake company, HashiCorp, at the end of the year. This follows him stepping down as CEO back in 2016 and leaving the board of directors in 2021. Now, he wrote a blog post detailing his departure, and it was positive and focused on positive relationships and building success with HashiCorp. But of course, being a departure of a namesake founder, there's speculation about what this means and whether it's related to licensing changes or anything like that. Now, his post also didn't mention what he was going to do next, and of course, that leads to speculation too. Tom, I know you don't have any kind of insider knowledge, but what's your take on Mitchell Hashimoto leaving HashiCorp?
Can a guy be tired for once? I mean, I get the idea. There's got to be something going on. But when you look at the blog post that he put up there, I think he's just kind of reached the end of one of the journeys of his life. And you don't get that whole like putting the brakes on everything like you normally see, like when we see an executive that's just like dismissed out of nowhere, right? Like he stepped down as a CEO 7 years ago, almost 8 years ago now. He stepped down from the board of directors. He kind of wanted to be in the background a little bit. And to his credit, he stayed out of it. Like sometimes you get those founders, those executives who say they're stepping back, but they're really not. They're just stepping to the side so that they can kind of stage manage things. It really did feel like Mitchell stepped away. And if you read up on some of the other stuff that's been going on in his life, I mean, he just had a baby. And if there's anything I can tell you about baby girls, they need a lot of attention. So, Mitchell, you're going to have your hands full with that one. But to kind of take it on the track of what does this mean about the licensing thing? Because I heard a lot of that, right? It's like, oh, you know, HashiCorp changed their licenses last year and everybody hated it. You know, is this why he's stepping down? I don't think this is why he is stepping down. Obviously, There's a lot of other things. Do I think that maybe the direction of the company had an impact in deciding to do it? Possibly. And partially because when you're in that kind of in the background position and you can kind of read the tea leaves and see where things are going, maybe you say, maybe it is time for me to step away. I'm not going to do it right after the licensing change, because then that feels like, you know, I'm protesting that even if I'm not. But to a degree, if Mitchell founded the company, and I'm speculating here, of course, editorializing, Mitchell founded the company to build cool stuff and do cool things. And if I can turn a profit with it, great, but it's not my primary focus. That's one thing. But if you step away and the people who have stepped into that spot are more driven to make products or change it so that other people can't profit off your work, if that runs counter to your beliefs, then maybe it is time to look for a better pasture to graze in, or to spend more time on smaller projects. There's a rumor that he's working on a TTY project that he just recently updated the developer blog for. And if that's the case, cool. Low impact, time to chill with the family, enjoy retirement for as long as it lasts. I mean, the outpouring of kudos for this man to be able to walk away on his own terms has been wonderful to read. So I think ultimately this was a good move for him to kind of get out while things were at a good place. And I think we will see him pop up again, maybe not in such a prominent role. He's going to continue to work on the things he wants to work on. And honestly, maybe one day we'll be hearing about, you know, his daughter doing something revolutionary or amazing in the tech industry. And if so, it'll be great, because she'll have gotten that fostering, that nurturing from someone who really did it right in the industry. Stephen, Intel has launched their fifth generation Intel Xeon SP line back in December. The Emerald Rapids Xeons are manufactured on a 10 nanometer Intel 7 process and have introduced the new Raptor Cove core. Despite taking their place as Intel's top server CPU, Emerald Rapids is entering a very crowded market because it faces very stiff competition from AMD's EPYC line, as well as any of the new ARM server CPUs that we've been seeing pop up. The release also coincides with a challenging server market amid industry growth still being sluggish after we've been dealing with COVID and all of these cloud initiatives that have been going on. Should we still be excited about riding these Emerald Rapids, Stephen?
Well, sure. And I think that sometimes in this industry, people get so excited with the little product introductions here and now and the technical advantages of this product over that product that they lose sight of how the industry really works. And how the industry really works is that people buy an awful lot of stuff, and sometimes it's not the best possible stuff on a technical level or even on a pricing level. It's the stuff that makes the most sense for them. And Emerald Rapids is basically the thing that makes the most sense for a heck of a lot of server vendors out there. So let's start off by basically setting the level here. This is technically the fifth generation of the Xeon scalable processor lineup. Now, Xeon SP is the line of processors that are used in everything from the data center to the cloud to embedded systems. And these are really the mainstream products from Intel in the server and data center world. Similarly, you could think of the Core lineup, the familiar Core names in the desktop and mobile world. Well, Xeon SP is that for the data center. This is the fifth generation. It follows the introduction of Sapphire Rapids earlier in 2023. And actually, as a fun fact, that means that Intel's top server CPU went through three different iterations in the same year, 2023, which is honestly a really good sign that Intel really is kind of getting their act in order in terms of delivering on the promises that they made. Now, as you probably know, the previous generation took a very long time to come out and was probably about a year and a half too late to really be competitive with AMD. AMD revved their line as well this year, and that means that Emerald Rapids may look a little bit late as well. But it improves on a lot of things. First off, it is compatible with the previous, with the fourth generation, which means that you can just plop one of these into the same motherboard as the fourth generation Xeon SP and get new features and compatibility. that doesn't mean that there won't be new platforms that support Emerald Rapids, but it is a nice, easy upgrade path. Another thing is Intel basically revved all the things in the CPU. The number of cores has been bumped up from 60 to 64 maximum. But of course, most people may not be buying those top-end CPUs. They may be buying the smaller core count CPUs, in which case you won't see as much of a difference between what you were buying in terms of fourth generation Xeon and what you might buy next time in terms of fifth generation Xeon. Each of those cores is going to perform a little bit better, which of course it will, in terms of absolute performance, but also in terms of power performance, because Intel is stepping up to what they call their Intel 7 process. Now, this is still 10 nanometers in terms of light, but it is competitive in terms of density to 7 nanometer processes from other companies. And this is, an example of Intel actually meeting the expectations that they set out for themselves and rolling out new process nodes. It has many other important aspects and elements included with it. Like I said, it's faster, it's got more cache, more cores. UltraPath has been boosted in terms of performance. It's just faster and better in every sort of way. One big thing that I'm keying in on is that Intel finally, officially, 100%, yes, absolutely, supports CXL Type 3 memory expansion. Now, as we talked about earlier on the rundown, Samsung has finally, Samsung has now got an officially supported CXL expansion part that is supported by Red Hat that just works. Intel now has a server platform that they support that kind of memory expansion on, which means that we can get to this world of CXL memory right sizing, and that's just good news for everyone. Now, technically, this is still CXL 1.1, not 2.0, but CXL has marvelous backward compatibility, and it is absolutely a supported configuration. In addition to that, of course, Intel Emerald Rapids supports faster DDR5 memory, which gives a decent boost in performance there, too. So overall, what should you take away about Emerald Rapids? It's a bump up over the previous generation. It does everything a little bit better. It does everything with a little bit less power. It gives you a little bit more performance. And frankly, that's what a lot of the market is looking for here. Is it revolutionary? No. We can't wait to see what Intel comes up with next. We can't wait to see some of the rumored cores that might come out using their Intel E cores in the Xeon platform and things like that. But right now, basically, they just released, the new Honda Accord, and it's great. So go buy one, I guess. Sometimes you roll the dice and come up short. In the case of Adobe, that's going to be about $20 billion short, as they called off their proposed acquisition of Figma in mid-December. The deal was facing major scrutiny from regulators about reducing competition in the creativity software market. This news came as Adobe rejected proposals to remedy the situation in order to allow the purchase to continue. They've stated that they will be exploring ways to utilize AI, hey, that's the name of our podcast, to help augment features in their flagship software suite, but it won't be with Figma.
Here's the thing, and normally we wouldn't even care, right? Because Steven and I are obviously not Photoshop wizards, but this says more about how acquisitions are going to drive AI adoption in the space. So Adobe had been looking to pick up Figma for a couple of years, and there was, good synergy and all this other stuff. You know, the kind of things that you tell regulators when you want it to go through, except the EU regulators are like a skeptical grandmother, and they're like, really though? Really? And so they were taking a really long, hard look at this, enough that it kind of, like, within hours of the announcement that kind of, this is going to be a really, really deep look, and they weren't sure that they were going to let it go, Adobe and Figma just kind of walked away from the whole thing. And then immediately Adobe is like, well, we're just going to use more AI stuff. Because in the time from the announcement that they were going to acquire Figma to today, the amount of technology that has grown up around AI has eclipsed what we possibly could have thought even just a year ago. And so Adobe now feels comfortable saying, rather than investing $20 billion into an acquisition of a company that we're going to have to also then spend more money integrating and trying to unlock that synergy, that value potential, why don't we just spend that $20 billion or some smaller subset of it on doing our own homegrown AI that we then own, that we know works with the product, and we don't have to sort out any of these messes, or worse yet, get rid of people that are duplicated job titles in the new organization, all that other messy stuff that you don't want to do behind the scenes. So I think what you're going to see going forward is there are going to be some big acquisitions, but they're not going to start until we know for a fact they're going to clear regulators, because the regulators are going to be very, very, they're going to take a very close, hard look at how much competition this is going to reduce in the market. That's their job, right? And we've seen it with EU regulators, US regulators, Chinese regulators, those big three. So a lot of companies are going to look at the cost benefit analysis and say, well, if this is going to tie up a lot of my money and time, why am I not just going to go invest over here in this new magic sauce that I can pour all over my product and it will do more than I could have possibly imagined, because AI is magic and I don't have to worry about clearing regulators. I just have to deal with these thorny issues of what AI is capable of doing, but we'll kick that can down the road. So I think in 2024, the amount of acquisitions is going to go down. The price tags are going to go up, but a lot of companies are going to make these bigger announcements about AI being a bigger component of their software products because it's just cheaper in the long run. All right, Stephen, speaking of AI, we had a story that we wanted to take a little bit of a closer look at, because while 2023 may have been the year of AI, I'm sure that 2024 isn't going to slow down anytime soon. And Intel is a company that has been stepping up their game in the AI ecosystem. Both Meteor Lake and the recent Emerald Rapids Xeon SP processors that we just talked about are being positioned as edge computing powerhouses. From running AI workloads on end-user systems to providing support for AI frameworks throughout the infrastructure, Intel's looking to break into a market that has been dominated by big players right now. Perhaps we should sit down and take a little bit of a look at why Intel sees so much promise here, but also talk about the hurdles that they're going to have to clear, because this is a crowded market.
It is a crowded market, and it's one that Intel faces some competition in, isn't it? I think that the elephant in the room on this entire discussion is the fact that Intel really doesn't have the same kind of GPU capability that we see from competitors like NVIDIA and AMD. And in fact, AMD rocked the world with their MI300 announcement in December, showing that they actually are competitive with the mainstream NVIDIA AI GPU accelerator market. Intel is, we'll see. It's interesting that Intel seems to be playing basically a couple of different cards at once here. Now, first off, what Intel is saying is that it's not just about the GPU. So they are trying to make a very big point that not all AI needs a big honking GPU. And this is 100% true. The Intel is absolutely dead on right about this. Many, many AI applications, especially the kind of applications in your hand, don't need a GPU at all. What you need is an NPU, a low-powered processor-adjacent accelerator that allows you to do inferencing tasks. And in fact, we have seen the power of this over and over and over again. Man, Apple just released a really, really interesting research paper showing how they can run a very large AI model in a very small envelope of RAM and flash and compute performance and deliver kind of the kind of high-end inferencing that you would expect from a GPU cluster out there in the cloud. This is going to be where AI comes into its fruition here in 2024. Essentially, I'm going to say that Intel is right about this. In other words, the sort of AI processing that we need and we will use in everyday applications don't need a GPU. They need an NPU, which is basically a special purpose processing unit that are being rolled out everywhere by everyone, including, yes, AMD and ARM and NVIDIA and RISC-V and Samsung and Apple, and yes, Intel. They also need many of these functions to be done right there on the CPU, which, again, this is happening from everywhere, from AMD, from ARM processors, from Apple, from Intel. Everybody's running AI processing right there on the CPU for very low intensity applications. Then you have to step back and you have to say, well, what about training? What about some of the heavier duty workloads? Well, that's not really what Intel is talking about here, but Intel does have something of a solution there. And that solution is called Gaudi. Intel bought a company called Habana Labs a few years ago. Gaudi is interesting because it is not a GPU. It is an ASIC. It is a special performance, a special purpose processor designed specifically to do AI stuff. This is the direction, actually, that companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft are heading as well. Rather than trying to leverage GPU technology to do AI workloads, they're saying, wait a second, what if we just create special AI chips? And of course, the lines are blurring here, because if you look at what NVIDIA and AMD are doing, those chips are really becoming machine learning ASICs as much as they are GPUs, but they're coming at it from the other direction. So basically, that's Intel's strategy. And it really matches what Intel's strategy has historically been. Intel has always said high-performance CPUs, lots of accelerators, both close and far, and, you know, let's make it happen at a huge, huge manufacturing base and affordable market pricing, and let's see what happens. Whereas companies like NVIDIA and AMD and the rest are basically trying to attack that in different ways, the same question in different ways. But Intel's strategy actually makes a lot of sense here if you step away from the fact that it does seem a little bit embarrassing that they don't have a GPU that's competitive with AMD and NVIDIA.
Well, you brought it up perfectly, because I know the parallels to this back in the day when companies were making ASICs for doing networking stuff, and Intel came up with this crazy harebrained idea. What if we did networking on x86? And if you don't think that DPDK had a huge impact on the industry, you're wrong, because Intel said maybe ASICs make sense for these things, but not these other things. And without DPDK proving that a desktop class CPU, if you want to call it that, is capable of doing these things, I don't think we would have gotten to the point where we have a market for DPUs, IPUs, NPUs, these application-specific offload processors. I mean, yeah, we've seen that there. We have the offload cores in some of the big Xeons, but this idea that we can write code to a specific kind of processor. So I like the way that Intel is basically saying, you don't need to invest the whole farm to get a chip that is really good at doing a couple of things, but maybe not great for the general purpose stuff that you want to do. The question, though, is can they steer that ship? Because the dark cloud, if you want to say that, is, yeah, Intel did change the game with DPDK. Where is it now? And you're not going to like the answer, because a lot of those assets have been packaged up and moved off to greener pastures, whether they were sold off or just overall stopped, is not a positive spin on the thing. But again, Pat Gelsinger fanboy, he knows that you can revolutionize an industry and still not make any money in it. So what you've got to do is you got to focus on the core of business that makes you money. And I think he sees a lot of Intel money out there for these non-hyper optimized AI platforms. How many times in the industry have you heard someone say something to the effect of, I wish company X would make stuff for me, not for the Fortune 5 or Fortune 50. So if you want to do a little Mad Lib here, I wish NVIDIA, AMD would stop making AI for Facebook, Google, and make stuff that I can use at my small business or my medium business. Well, that's what Intel is going to do, is they're going to go around and they're going to pick that up. Lower cost chips, less power usage. Maybe you're not going to be able to train, you know, GPT-6 on a pocket computer, but why would you want to? You're not doing those kinds of things. You're doing different things. And that, I think, is where Intel can establish some dominance. Yeah, maybe they're not neck and neck for one and two, but they are the dominant number three for everything else that one and two aren't fighting for.
And I think that it's important to note, too, that Intel has really has their finger on the pulse of the market here when it comes to PCs. Yes, AMD's offerings are excellent, but Intel outsells them so far. And the reason is because Intel, again, they know this market. This is their market. So when it comes to the end user, the edge, the client device, Intel has done a remarkable job there. I know Apple stuff is great. Bear with me. What Intel's doing is they are delivering what, you know, the right part in the right spot here. And again, that's something that nerds like me don't like, because we like to look at the big number. We like to say, but, you know, NVIDIA, you know, but AMD, but, you know, most people aren't buying those. And frankly, if you look at what Intel is rolling out here, with their latest Core Ultra and Evo, they're delivering what a lot of customers are going to end up buying, which are basically more efficient, better processors, and processors that do AI, frankly, really, really well. And this leads us to a new thing. Intel is touting the a renaissance in PC construction called the AI PC. Have you heard of this, Tom?
No, I haven't. What is this thing?
So this is a kind of an interesting thing. Intel and many other companies besides, including the companies that I've just named, are saying that we are on the cusp of a revolution here in terms of a new type of computer, an AI PC. What is an AI PC? Well, PCs, you know, have been in the past oriented toward the CPU. Originally, that's what you were buying. Essentially, you bought a computer with a powerful CPU. Then there was a coprocessor that was brought into the mix so that it could do math. And again, Intel led the way on that too, in the kind of the 286, 386, 486 era. The next wave, the next generation of PC architecture, and by PC, I mean both client devices, but also edge, point of sale, industrial control, you know, IoT, all those kind of things nowadays. Those are all basically PCs as well. The next generation was all about the GPU. And again, Intel was a little bit lagging here. They failed to compete in the GPU market in the early 2000s. They failed again in the 2010s. And here we are in the 2020s, and they have a better and better and better GPU platform, but it's still not, you know, what AMD is offering. But that said, Intel feels like they can leapfrog this whole world with this new AI PC world. So an AI PC is effectively the same thing as like a gaming PC with a really nice GPU was, except that instead of being optimized toward gaming, it's optimized toward AI. And instead of being a GPU, it has a specialized AI processing capability, whether that's a GPU or an NPU or an ASIC or just a pretty awesome CPU. Effectively, this is what companies are delivering today. If you look at what Apple has done with their Apple Silicon processors, those are AI PC processors. Same thing with Google and their Tensor. Yes, those are AI PCs as well, even though it looks like a phone. Intel is promising to bring that to the desktop, and Intel and Microsoft are working to basically integrate AI throughout the operating system. And I know Apple is doing the same in Mac OS. The next PC that you buy in 2024 or 2025 will probably have a lot of very quiet but very powerful AI features in it. Things like operating systems that sort of watch what you do and optimize their functionality to support what you're doing. You know, instead of having everything function the same, maybe the features of the OS, moving around, finding files, you know, opening applications at different times of day, all that kind of stuff. Maybe all that stuff is learning with you and assisting you. Applications, you know, that learn what you do. Things under the hood that are learning what you're doing and optimizing the performance of the machine. We already have some features like this. You know, my laptop doesn't charge over 80% when I'm at work because it knows that I don't need that and it's saving the battery. You know, that's pretty cool. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's a basic rule that Apple implemented in macOS, but the next generation PCs are going to do a lot more than that. And Intel is betting that this world of the AI PC will give them an advantage over companies, well, like AMD, certainly, but also ARM-based PCs and the rest, because Intel has, again, their finger on the pulse of what corporate and home PC buyers are looking for, and they can try to optimize their product toward that. Now, one of the challenges here is, number one, nobody knows what an AI PC is yet, so there's a marketing challenge. Number two, there's no telling that these features will actually be compelling and that people will actually want them and that customers will be demanding them and that, you know, that'll lead to something. Another big problem that I see looming here is that it will be a little hard to measure and to demonstrate the value of an AI PC. How do you benchmark this thing? I guess you could run some AI workloads on it, but are people really going to value that? And is that really going to be reflective of real world use? I think, honestly, that companies like Apple that have a vertically integrated software and hardware stack are actually going to have a better chance of delivering on the AI PC promise simply because they can basically push it out there as the next operating system and hardware platform together. Whereas Intel, working with companies like Microsoft, are going to have to try to make progress in a more fragmented ecosystem. So essentially, the AI PC is Intel's idea, not just for the next PC, but also for how they leapfrog the incredible advances in GPU that NVIDIA and AMD have and deliver something that's even more powerful and even more impactful for customers. And we will see if it works out.
Well, thank you, Stephen. That was a great overview of AI PCs. And as you can tell from these stories, AI is something we're going to be talking a lot about in 2024. But we've got some great events coming up that we wanted to let you know about. The first one, of course, goes to Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, what have you got going on at the end of the month that people should be looking at?
Well, the end of the month, we've got Cloud Field Day coming. So if you're interested in the enterprise cloud, hybrid cloud, and the real cloud, tune in for that. A wide variety of companies coming. A lot of really cool stuff. I'm pleased to say that it's going to be well attended on both a company and delegate side. And we're also very excited because this is the first event that we're bringing Futurum analysts to the table here for Cloud Field Day. We also have, I might point out, an AI Field Day coming up in mid-February. And again, that one's going to be a little bit off the hook. We've got some great sponsors and presenters from across the AI world. And we're going to be kicking off a new season of the Utilizing AI podcast to coincide with it. But before that, Tom, I know you've got a couple of things.
You're right. Pack your Stroop waffles, grab a shot glass of Genever, because we're going to be in Amsterdam for Cisco Live EMEA. We are excited to be talking from our friends at Cisco. They've got some great stuff they want us to hear about across a wide variety of networking, security, wireless technologies. And we're going to be interviewing some great companies while we're there as well. You know, you can always see those interviews on our website, both techfieldday.com and gestaltit.com. We're also going to be getting a sneak peek at some cool technologies that you may hear about at Networking Field Day, which will be taking place at the end of February, the 28th and the 29th. We're going to be hearing from Nile and Forward Networks and many other companies that we'll be adding to the website very soon. Techfieldday.com is your place to learn all about that. And you can also see all the delegates that are going to be there. I got lots of excited responses yesterday when I told them that they were going to be able to show up and have fun with us. And they're ready to kick off 2024, make a big splash, have some excitement. And we're very glad that we could kick off 2024 with you. Last Wednesday, I was, you know, it's that week between Thanksgiving and Christmas. We don't know what planet we're on or if it's, you know, March yet. And I didn't have the usual rundown recording to ground me because Wednesday at 12:30 was not as exciting without Stephen and I talking about some great news. Don't worry. We're going to be doing that for the next 50 weeks. We've got lots of great stories that are going to be coming out, whether they're about AI or acquisitions or, you know, pretty much anything you can think of. If you want to watch our videos, you can do that at gestaltit.com or on our YouTube channel. Just search for Gestalt IT. You can also check out our podcast, Gestalt IT Rundown, if you'd like to listen to this when you're snow plowing the front driveway or whatever it is that people who live in places that get snow do. But other than that, if you have any news stories that you want to send our way, you know, you can reach out to us. We're always happy to see those. And we appreciate you being a part of all of the great stuff that we do. So for Stephen Foskett, myself, Tom Hollingsworth, we hope that you had a happy new year. We hope that you have those planners filled out for 2024. Stay on that exercise routine. Just keep doing it. Until next week, we will be getting great news stories gathered up for you. Take care, be safe, and we will see you soon.